Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent.
Later this week, Donald Trump will host Hungarian leader Viktor Orban at his Mar-a-Lago resort. This comes as it remains in doubt whether the U.S. Congress will pass badly needed military aid to Ukraine amid signs that Vladimir Putin and Russia are making new gains in the war. All these developments are related, and not in a good way. Trump's romance with Orban and the opposition of MAGA Republicans to helping Ukraine are part of the same story in which the American right is increasingly besotted with Putin and other assorted dictators, including Orban and, of course, would-be dictator for a day, Donald Trump. Here to discuss all this is Jacob Heilbrun, author of a great new book called America Last: The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. The relevance of that to the current moment speaks for itself. Welcome, Jacob.
Thanks, Greg.
So why does Viktor Orban want to meet with Trump, and why is Trump happy to oblige? What does Orban get out of a meeting with Trump, and what does Trump get out of a meeting with Orban?
They have a mutual interest. For Orban, it's instant access to the White House should Trump win a second term. Hungary's prominence within the European Union would be immensely bolstered. And Orban is seeking to join an alliance of Russia, Hungary, and the United States. Trump, for his part, has made no secret of his admiration for Orban's illiberal democracy. In fact, he issued a congratulatory message to him at the last CPAC in May in Budapest, which I tried to attend but was denied entrance. So there is a coincidence of interests. They see the world the same way. They're both strong men. They both despise democracy. And Orban serves as a lodestar for the American right, particularly at the Heritage Foundation.
Well, I want to get into that in a bit, but first I want to read you something Orban said last week. Quote, "We would like to see Trump return to the White House and make peace here in the eastern half of Europe," close quote. Meanwhile, Orban recently held out against a European Union aid package to Ukraine, though he ultimately caved. What does Orban really want out of the Russia-Ukraine war? What does he mean by calling for, quote, peace in Eastern Europe, close quote? And in what sense does he see Trump as a kind of ally in securing that?
Trump has made no secret of his antipathy towards Volodymyr Zelensky, since he did not accede to his wishes to meddle in the election, as Trump wished, by targeting his enemies. And Trump wanted to concoct a conspiracy scandal through Zelensky that would tarnish Joe Biden. He would terminate all aid to Ukraine and withdraw the extensive CIA operations that the New York Times reported on last week that are performing a vital function in helping the Ukrainians to stave off Russia. For Orban, he has made no secret of his admiration for Putin. He would like to see Putin conquer much of Ukraine. Perhaps Hungary would receive some of the irredentist territory that it covers from Ukraine as well.
Right. And what does Trump get out of this? I mean, in this up is down worldview, peace means letting Russia erase the Ukrainian people and their sovereign democracy through something like genocidal conquest and horrific war crimes. This use of the term peace seems telling. Both Trump and Orban say some version of this, right? Trump kind of vacillates between saying, if I were president, it never would have happened and we would have had peace, or saying, if I get back in, this thing will end in a second. What do they really mean by peace here?
They're talking about an appeasement policy. I mean, by giving Putin a piece, if not all, of Ukraine to create a pseudo peace. I think it's part of Trump's larger desire to exit NATO and to have Putin control a sphere of influence over the Baltic states and over chunks of Eastern, potentially Central Europe, so that the United States can allow the Europeans to live in a kind of Finlandized moment, and so that the United States can withdraw from Europe and return to where it was before World War II.
And that's what they both mean by peace. So can you just recap for our listeners what Orban's broader vision of, quote, illiberal democracy, close quote, really is? He gave a speech recently talking about the upcoming election in the U.S. as a crossroads moment for the world's democracies. And as your book chronicles, the right's worship of this vision and the men who would implement it has a long history in the U.S. What is this vision? What is illiberal democracy?
Illiberal democracy, in the manner that Orban has fashioned it, is not fully similar to Putin's rule. Putin is a neo-Stalinist dictator. He just assassinated another one of his political adversaries, Alexei Navalny. He is terrorizing the Russian population. He's waging a brutal war of conquest. Those are not things that Orban is intent upon. He is what I call in my book, drawing on the British historian Edward Gibbon, a subtle tyrant. He maintains the forms of democracy with elections that don't really amount to much. He has given over businesses to his cronies. He has eviscerated the judiciary in Hungary. All of these things have created what he calls an illiberal democracy. He is not going around locking up his opponents en masse, nor do you have to watch your words in Budapest. You're not under the overt threat of a secret police. That is, I think, the distinction. And I think the more likely road that Trump would follow as well.
Well, I hate to associate Trump with the word subtle, but subtle tyranny seems pretty apt, doesn't it?
It does. And it's in some ways, it's more insidious because, again, the forms of democracy would be maintained in Trump's USA, but it would proceed salami style, slice by slice, so that it did not trigger as much outrage all at once.
Right. And in this context, I think we need to ask some deeper questions about what a Trump victory in the 2024 election would mean for a lot of people around the world. There's kind of a global far right taking shape that sees what you're talking about, or at least the range of different, modes of dictatorship, from subtle to not so subtle, as models for a different kind of international order. Right? What is the international order that they envision?
Well, Putin's claim is that he's going to lead a new multipolar opposition to Western hegemony. That's the Russian propaganda, hence also the alliance with China. And Putin is reaching out to India. He wants to counter what he sees as a devastating defeat that was inflicted upon the Soviet Union in 1989. Remember, he called the collapse of communism the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. I think in this sense, he is somewhat of a Hitlerian figure, an obscure person. He was an agent in Dresden when the Berlin Wall came down. He drove back to St. Petersburg with his wife And this guy has been plotting revenge ever since. And actually, it's turned out to be a brilliantly effective strategy.
Certainly has. Your book compellingly goes into Putin's appeal to certain segments of the right, even before Trumpism, but very much through Trumpism. You quote Pat Buchanan saying, "Putin puts Russia first." As you explain in the book, this is really a vision of how sovereign nations should situate themselves in the global order, right? For the Trumpist right, in a sense, it's a good thing for Ukraine to be left at the mercy of Putin and Russia's sphere of influence, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you have Colonel Doug McGregor, who appears regularly on Fox. He said right from the beginning, Ukraine should surrender to the Russians. It should not fight. It has no business trying to counter them. Joe Biden is doing in supporting the Ukrainians is using them as cannon fodder. And they see Putin as a decisive leader who embodies Christian values, that he is in fact a defender of older Western values against the decadence that you see in the United States, that the Putin is actively opposed to LGBTQ rights. He sends the police in to gay bars to arrest people in Moscow now. They've stressed family values. It's an extremely old-fashioned, hierarchical, authoritarian vision.
And I want to get into that in a bit. I think Jeet here has said somewhere that the analog of leaving Ukraine to the Russian sphere of influence, the analog of this in the U.S. is something like MAGA Republicans threatening to bomb Mexican drug cartels without Mexico's consent. The way I envision it is like this. It's why someone like Ron DeSantis calls Russia's conquest of Ukraine a quote-unquote border dispute. The basic idea is the U.S. should be free to handle the problem with the Mexican border however it wants, including invading Mexico and shooting migrants at the border if necessary, just as Putin should be left to handle those making trouble about Russia's borders however he wants. Is that overstating it, or is that pretty much what it is?
There's something to it, though I doubt that the MAGA Republicans would enjoy the consequences of invading Mexico. It didn't go well for the United States in the past when Woodrow Wilson sent the Marines in. If we want to get embroiled in another war on our, that I don't think it would turn out well. The way Putin is doing it is the only way that you could probably do it successful. I mean, if you're prepared to wage a genocidal war and sacrifice innumerable numbers of soldiers, then maybe you can win something that resembles a success. But there's no stomach for that in the United States.
Right. And I think what we're really looking at here is something bigger, right? A kind of global, mutually admiring alliance of illiberal authoritarians, isn't it? Alan Elrod put it well recently, I think. He called this an anti-liberal internationale, and noted that if Trump wins, it could push this kind of politics toward the peak of their global power and appeal, as he put it. That, I think, is what's at stake for people like Orban and others around the world looking at our election, right?
Yes, and I think you could see the rise of Marine Le Pen in France and the rise of the AfD, the far-right party in Germany, when people sense that the global political climate is changing and they feel at risk, it would certainly embolden these far-right forces on the continent. And who knows? It's an open question what would happen in Great Britain as well, where you see these populist forces surging.
I want to dig into what this international vision is really made of. In your book, and I love this part, you write that Orban's appeals to the American right are rooted in Volkish ethno-nationalism. You get at this all throughout. What exactly is Volkish ethno-nationalism?
Well, it really came to the fore in the 19th century in Austria and in Germany. And historians like Fritz Stern and George Masi, Stern wrote a book called The Politics of Cultural Despair. And they focused on these what now look like strange figures who argued that there was a special German essence, that there was a relation to the soil, that Germany had a special mission, that it was unique among nations. It's ethno-nationalism. And that emerged most strongly in Austria and in Vienna. And I talk in the book about how I think the founder of all of this is a Viennese mayor named Karl Lueger, who fused Christian pop. He created this conservative populism, Christian socialism. And he was a demagogue and an anti-Semite, and Hitler revered him. And I think that set the foundation for what we've witnessed in the 20th century and today.
Right. And to bring this up to the present, I want to talk to you about how the confluence of two things in this worldview work, right? One is migration and the other is anti-wokeness. These things interlock, I think, and in a way that goes underappreciated. The U.S. MAGA right wants strongman rule that drastically limits migration while also rolling back gains in LGBTQ and reproductive rights, which they see as a cause of declining native birth rates. That decline plus migration are the twin threats to the ethno-nation, and the strongman will stop those threats in their tracks. That seems like the connecting thread to me, linking the U.S. right's embrace of Orbanism to some of these pathologies in the past. They want this here in defense of what they imagine is our ethno-nation, right?
Exactly. And the interesting thing is in the book, I talk about how Mussolini gave a major speech emphasizing the need for Italians to produce more babies. I think he wanted 55 million Italians by 1952 or something. And that is a theme that Orban has picked up as well with his family policies, and something that the Trumpists actively admire, something that Senator J.D. Vance talks about too. What it really is code word for they want more white babies and they want to sever immigration into the U.S. So this gets back to what I talk about in the early part of the book, where there was a book in 1920 called The Rising Tide of Color that betrayed darker skin races as threatening Western unity, and that we would be submerged under this rising tide of color. And that was their version of the Great Replacement.
You know, I was just about to bring up Great Replacement theory. I think people kind of laugh at it when someone like Elise Stefanik traffics in it, or they sort of chortle at Tucker Carlson using it. But there really is a real argument behind Great Replacement theory, and it links up directly with what you're talking about, right? The idea is that globalist elites are scheming to replace the native born in each one of these ethno-nations, putting them under siege. Elon Musk dabbles in this. Trump and MAGA Republicans push it constantly. They call migration and LGBTQ/abortion rights threats to civilization. So what do they mean by civilization? It's this kind of constellation of ethno-nations that can all handle their own borders however the fuck they want, right? Isn't that what it is?
Definitely. And it gets back to this idea of what the Los Angeles Times in 1924 called Nordic supremacy. It is about, and the argument back then was that we had lost the best of the white race in World War I, and that our racial stock was being depleted. And it is uncanny how those arguments from the past have lingered on down to the present, not just lingered on, but now they have erupted with particular force. So as you were saying, it's easy to just dismiss or deride these ideas, but they do have an intellectual provenance, however bogus it may be.
And not only that, right? It's a real worldview of large segments of one of the two major political parties in the United States now.
Yes, it's quite amazing. But my own take is that the Republican Party is reverting to its pre-World War II traditions, and that those traditions may in the end prove to be sturdier than the ones that were grafted onto it by Dwight D. Eisenhower and other establishment Republicans starting in the early 1950s.
So here we come full circle in a way, back to why a certain faction of Republicans in the U.S. wants a Putin victory, right? Why exactly is Putin losing such a threat to the right-wing Internationale's global vision?
Because they believe in the infallibility of the strongman. If you remove that nimbus of success, it can start to raise doubts about their own leader, is my interpretation. And Trump has backed Putin so vociferously, called him a genius when he first invaded Ukraine. Then when the invasion went belly up, it started to make Trump look less than infallible.
Aren't they also essentially sort of saying, look, here's an alternate international order to the failing liberal international order?
100%. And that's why they are continually regurgitate Putin's own propaganda about his society. And that's why they claim that it's inevitable that Russia will win. And they admire the steps that they believe Putin has taken to revivify his own society against Western decadence. They share the view, they share Putin's view that we are weak and decadent right now under a liberal regime. At the core of this, and at the core of the ethno-nationalism that existed in the 19th century and exists today, is a hatred for liberalism.
Right. And also, I think what we're talking about here is a sort of very deeply held genuine belief that globalization kind of pollutes and dilutes the strength of these kind of ethno-nationalist configurations that, if they defend themselves, can not just revivify, but can kind of change the way that the whole international order functions, right? Isn't there something really big at stake here?
Definitely, because as you're suggesting, it would mean that each society could determine and protect its what they would construe as their own bloodlines without being, as Trump put it, polluted by foreign blood.
Yes, it's really, I think, crucial to draw this through line, to go back to the Orban-Trump alliance, right? Orban has said that he doesn't want Hungary to be, quote unquote, mixed race. Donald Trump recently has gone straight out into the public domain with explicit white nationalism by saying migrants poison the blood of the United States. That's the through line, right?
It is. And if you believe in a multicultural America, then it sounds ominous. If you think, as Trump's followers apparent, or many of them do, that they're under siege, then his is a winning message.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? What is this this concept of being under siege? So I think the border is misunderstood as a trope by a lot of people, right? For the right, this type of right-wing thought, the border is not a place where we're actually trying to figure out how to manage migration and trade, right? It's the locus point for the weakening of the ethno-nation and the siege of the ethno-nation. Isn't that right? I mean, that's what they really mean when they say border crisis.
Yeah, I mean, Trump put it right from the beginning, didn't he, in 2016, when he said criminals and rapists are coming across the border. These are not people who are contributing to American society, either culturally or economically. They're dangerous parasites, and they're out to wreak havoc on our country.
Right. And when they say that the country, that the border is in crisis and is under siege, right, what they really mean is that the true emergency is the browning of America. I think that's the thing that we really need to get at. They're not actually talking about the border as a real life thing. They're talking about the ethno-nation. The emergency is the threat to the integrity of the ethno-nation. That's the crisis.
Right, but I don't think they want to say that explicitly. I think there are a lot of smoke screens that get used, and it makes it more palatable that they create the perception that Joe Biden is unable to control this border rather than Joe Biden is unable to protect the ethnic and racial composition of the United States.
There you go. You nailed it right there. And so Trump made it absolutely explicit when he said that migrants are poisoning the blood of the country, right? And so in this sense, Orban's visit to Mar-a-Lago is really the latest meeting of the ethno-nationalist dictator club.
It is. And it also allows Trump to present himself as carrying out the functions of a president right now.
Yeah, it certainly will. Well, your book puts this into deeper and much more alarming context. Jacob Heilbrun, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you, Greg.
Folks, a couple of quick notes. Don't miss two pieces currently up at TNR.com. Michael Tomasky arguing that Biden must use his State of the Union address to sharply contrast his economic successes with Trump GOP plutocracy. And Jason Lincoln's on why Democrats must hammer away at all the nonstop GOP lies about abortion from now until November. We'll see you tomorrow. You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.